Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Heart of the Matter. Now, 2 weeks ago, you heard a program on the Mary Movement. That's what we looked at. It was actually a rebroadcast of an interview I did some years ago. But prior to that interview, we played an audio clip from a BBC television series on pilgrimages. And the specific clip that we played, the audio clip, had to do with the Anglo-Catholic shrine at Walsingham, England. And in that clip, you heard Pastor David Carson have an opportunity to share a brief word of warning against what he called, and rightly so, the occult nature of Romanism. He zeroed in on that. Well, we're going to follow up on that theme today by sharing some fantastic popish fables, grossly heathen superstitions. Now, I just described, didn't I, the heart of Romanism. And we could speak of many things, from the real presence in the Mass to claims about Romish relics and blood and bones and body organ and so forth. But we're going to stick to just sharing, I believe we'll primarily stick at least with David Carson and me, you never know, but we're going to stick to just sharing a few Romanist fables concerning a few of a multitude of pilgrimage sites. Now, I have David Carson on the phone from Chester, England, and I'm going to have him tell us a few such tales concerning pilgrimage sites in his country and perhaps beyond. But first, we'll welcome him, of course, but I'm also going to have him give us an update on the open-air ministry he's recently been involved in. So, David, as always, great to have you here. And what have you been doing recently out in the open air?
Well, we have been continuing with our normal open-air witness, which takes place on Saturday afternoons, weather permitting. But in addition, we have been witnessing to processions at this time of year, the really heathenish processions through the streets of Chester. I think I've mentioned this before. One is called Winter Watch that took place two Thursday evenings running in December. And it's led by a fellow painted up like the devil who's called Lord Misrule, which of course represents Satan. Mm-hmm. And then they have various groups with all sorts of grotesque skeletons, devil figures, snakes, ravens, you name it, parading along with their faces painted hideous, devilish colors. Even have a sort of a jazz band deliberately playing out of tune. The whole thing is to do with, you know, disorder and misrule. So we go up with, we don't preach at this because there's a lot of noise going on. We just stand with our banners that, such as Jesus Christ is the light of the world. I am the light of the world. He that follows me shall not walk in darkness, have the light of light. Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, and so on. And so we just stand there as it goes past us. It goes down the street and then back up. But it's, you know, medieval superstition coming back to life again. This has been happening for about 10 years now. And typical with Rome before the Reformation, there might be a few biblical references in there. For instance, wise men, there were three camels, paper mache ones, and angels and so on. But it's typical of what the friars used to speak to the people and the pageantry that used to take place prior to the Reformation. So then, week or so before Christmas, they have a thing which is called Saturnalia.
Before you go any further on that, back up. Is there a lot of people that come out to watch that then?
Maybe a couple of hundred. But okay. Sadly, they have sort of children drawn into it.
Ah. And so
that's a sad thing. But there may be a couple of hundred. There's not really as many as there used to be, thankfully.
You know, if we're going to focus on the pilgrimage sites, but if there's time, I may just share a little bit on the Day of the Dead, because it reminded me of this, a Roman Catholic event, especially in Latin America. But going back to that then, are you able to give out some tracts once in a while? Do you get confronted or have interaction?
No, they don't. But what we did do, not that particular time, but what they did do, they after they'd gone up the street, we then paraded with our banners. There were seven of us after them, you know, keeping a good distance between us and them.
Right.
But the people saw, you know, there was a Christian witness there.
That's great.
The photographs were taken of us, I don't know by whom, but who knows. But there is not a chance to engage, although a number of Christians, we think, anyway, came up and said they were glad that we were there, and one person had never seen it before. She thought it was absolutely awful, you know, what she saw. So we were encouraged in that respect, but it's not a case. It's not good for person to person unless people engage with us.
Yeah.
But we feel it's important that the Word of God is displayed, and hundreds would have seen it.
Absolutely.
So that was that one. And then this Saturnalia. Now, Saturnalia, of course, is where Christmas business comes from.
Right.
Worship of Saturn. Now, just to be in a Roman city, you see, they have, for the sake of the tourist people, dressed up as Roman soldiers and so on. So, again, there was a procession with them shouting things that would have been shouted in the days of Rome, and a lot of young children involved again in that, which is sad.
Very sad.
So we just held our banners and then followed them up with our banners aloft, and we were about to head back home when we met up with three Mormons. So we had a good witness to them for about three quarters of an hour. Two of them were from Tahiti, and one from Chile. The elder was from Chile, and the acolytes, as it were from Tahiti, which is strange. They didn't speak very good English, any of them. So why they had sent them over to over here, I don't know. But we got a lot of truth over, and I could see the two from Tahiti, you could see it hitting home. It was really unsettling them, you know.
You're talking about the younger ones?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that before when, you know, I've had a chance to witness to Mormons. Boy, the older ones get pretty upset, though. I mean, they'll pull those younger ones out of there pretty quick if, you know, if the younger ones are willing to go.
Well, he stayed put, but we had a person with us who had been briefly in the Mormons.
Oh, good.
And that was, you know, providential, so he was able to speak, as I say, from the inside out.
Yeah.
And, of course, we went through the whole thing about Joseph Smith and his wickedness and polygamy and the fact all these cities in America supposedly and battles with chariots and so on, and the wheel hadn't even been, was unknown in America. They had no horses in America till the Spaniards brought them, you know, and the Indians then tamed them and so on. And the fact, of course, recently they've done DNA checks with the Red Indians, as we call them, and of course there's no connection with the supposed tribes of Israel that went over there. And then we went on to the fact, you see, about salvation being by faith alone in Christ alone, and that he was God manifest in the flesh, which they deny, of course.
Yeah.
So we went through the whole thing with a good three quarters of an hour, but it was really good.
Yeah, that's great.
So while we didn't get to talk to the Saturnalia people, but we had a real good opportunity there.
Well, you talked to them with your banners.
Well, they came up to us, you see, because they saw the banners.
As far as Saturnalia people.
Oh, yeah.
You spoke to them.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Absolutely.
The word, well, you know, the entrance of thy word giveth light, and that's what we're there for. It's not, as I say, it's not a preaching type situation with the noise. It's quite brief anyway.
Yeah.
But we do feel it's important that there is a biblical witness with this influx now of heathenism.
Yeah.
But that's what we're going back to, you see.
Yeah, absolutely.
Normally also this time of year in our normal open-air witnesses, I find it very hard preaching at so-called Christmas time. People say, oh, it's a great opportunity. We find it usually the very opposite. It really hard. But this year I had good liberty in speaking, you know. And, I just preach sin, righteousness, judgment, no holds barred, but, you know, give them the remedy and so on. And we had a number of conversations and tracts went out, and, you know, we thank God we have the liberty to do this, and actually had liberty in preaching as well. So that's the sum total of our
recent ministry.
Open-air witness week by week, as I say, as the weather permits, because, of course, we get a lot of rain here.
Right, right. But, I mean, that's very encouraging to hear, just to hear you tell about it. It's just, it really encourages us here very much so. I want to go to the main event here and get right at this, because we're just going to scratch the surface, but we want to talk about some of these pilgrimage sites and just impress upon the hearts of our listeners, who maybe don't realize it, the utter heathenish superstition that is part and parcel of the Roman Catholic Church. I mean, as I said, we can go to many different things, but we're just going to go to these pilgrimage sites. Now, before I turn the mic over to you for a while, and you can tell us some of the background on pilgrimage sites in your country and perhaps beyond as well, I want to share just a bit on what's called the Shrine of the Holy House or Basilica of the Santa Casa, which is a Roman Catholic pilgrimage site in Loreto, Italy. It has this large ornate basilica, and within that is a house. It's a stone house, and the fable is that Mary, of course, the mother of Jesus, who the Roman Catholics call the Virgin Mary, there Mary, the mother of Jesus, as to his humanity, of course, was supposedly born and lived, and later, you know, with her, what they would call the Holy Family, always that's where they lived. Now, this pilgrimage site has had over the centuries the patronage and support of the popes. I want to make that clear so people realize, yes, the papacy does support these sort of things. Sixtus V erected a facade of the church and put a huge statue of himself in the middle of the front steps. Pope Paul V installed three huge bronze doors. The principal bell in the thing, which weighs 11 tons, was presented by Leo the 10th, and other popes have added their own personal touches. Now, this basilica, of course, has its share of Marian idols and artwork of various kinds. No expense has been spared on this pilgrimage site. Of course, there's precious jewels involved and precious metals and so on and so forth. Now, the center of attention of this whole thing is the so-called Holy House itself. It's supposedly the house, as I said, in which Mary, the mother of Jesus, grew up in and then lived in as an adult. It's a stone building. It's inside this big basilica, and it's a stone building. It has within a black image of the Romanist goddess and child, in this case, the Madonna of Loreto, that's done up in Lebanon cedar. And then it's all richly decked out with precious jewels. And there's other rich treasures there as well. The Vatican, the whole Roman Church is fabulously wealthy. And, of course, so you see this. And I want to give just a quick overview of the history of this fable, this supposed house where Mary lived. And I think you're going to give us, when I get done, a little connection to your country even. But we'll leave that for you. Well, the story, as it goes, of course, manufactured in Rome, is that the house in which Mary, Joseph, until his death, and the boy Jesus lived, and also Mary grew up in, was first converted into a church by the 12 apostles, and then it was flown by four angels to various places. There's several different versions, but as the story goes, it was flown out of Nazareth by four angels, just as the last of the Crusaders were being driven out so it wouldn't be destroyed by the Muslims. And then initially, as the fable goes, it was placed on a hill in Croatia, where the Virgin, as the Romanists call her, then appeared, and there were many miraculous cures which took place. Well, then next in 1294, here comes the angels again. They pick up the house and they carry it across the Adriatic Sea to a woods in Italy. And then finally it's removed to its present site in 1295 in Loreto. And then it's been a big pilgrimage site for the Roman Catholics. I just want to say one more thing. I know that was a quick overview of the facts. But again, the popes have supported this. There have been bulls issued by the various popes approving and supporting the site in Loreto, and the whole fable of the flying house which the angels planted there. And these have been issued by Pope Sixtus the IV in 1491, Julius II in 1507. Then Innocent the XII in the late 17th century appointed a special mass for the feast of the translation of the Holy House in And this is interesting. In 2012, specifically on October 4th of 2012, Benedict the 16th visited that shrine in Loretto to mark the 50th anniversary of John the 23rd's visit there. And, of course, during his time at the shrine, and therefore giving great approval to this and encouragement to the fable, Benedict formally entrusted the World Synod of Bishops and the Year of Faith to the Virgin of Loretto. So that is an overview of the fabulous, ridiculous, superstitious, heathen fable concerning this flying house, the four angels, the flying house, and the shrine at Loretto, Italy, which is a very big favorite with Catholic pilgrims. And I'm sure sometimes they get special indulgences and so on and so forth and are hoping for miracles by visiting there. Now, David, why don't you pick up from there and share a little bit, as I say, we're scratching the surface, but share some more concerning some of these Romanist fables and their pilgrimage sites. Maybe you should start with Walsingham because you've got an angle on that flying house there, too.
Well, yes. Obviously, they couldn't have the flying house in two places. Perhaps they hadn't gone intercontinental yet, but the fable at Walsingham was that the lady of the manor, Richeldus, had a vision from the Virgin Mary telling her to build a facsimile of the Holy House of Nazareth in the village of Walsingham. She had great difficulty getting it built because every time it was built at night it was tumbled down again, and then the Virgin appeared and told her she was building it in the wrong place, and then a well of water sprung up. There's always wells involved with these things.
Yeah.
And it became the site for pilgrimage in England, and the people from the continent even used to go there. Hmm. Henry VIII walked barefooted to it before the monasteries were dissolved. And I did find out from their pilgrimage program that one of the things that used to happen there was the merchants were selling the Virgin's milk to the pilgrims. So again, of course, this is the total deception, money-making racket, which, you see, when there's no Bible, this is what happens, you
mm-hmm.
see.
Yeah.
The Church of Rome was, and still is, of course, teaching these fables, so people were gullible enough to believe it.
Mm-hmm.
So we leave that one there because, you know, I've talked about Walsingham before, but that's the connection. I want to deal with a number of fables, and which still are in operation where Roman Catholics go on pilgrimage or visit. One is St. Winifred's Well, as it is called, in Holywell, correct pronunciation really, which is about 16 miles from Chester in North Wales. It's called the Lourdes of North Wales. And the legend is that in 660 in Wales, this Winifred resisted the advances of a Welsh prince called Caradoc. And he promptly cut off her head, and it... This happened supposedly in Snowdonia. You've been there yourself. And it hopped all the way, it bounced all the way and came to rest in Holywell. But everywhere where it bounced, a well sprung up. And so then it became a place of pilgrimage. Now, there are different stories surrounding this, all sorts of weird fables. But one of them is that her head sprang up on the edge of the well and started to preach to the people. So as we often say, you can't keep a good woman quiet. Then following that, her uncle, called St. Bruno, took her head and plonked it back on the shoulders, and she was back to normal, and she became an abbess. Then later after she died, her bones were taken to Shrewsbury in Shropshire, which would be about 50 miles from Chester, where there was an abbey set up, and it became a very big place of pilgrimage. Now, the pilgrimage to Holywell commenced at that period, continued throughout the medieval times, and still the Roman Catholics carry a statue of her down to the well in the end of June every year, and we go over there and witness. It's very small now. There's about 200 of them in the procession. But we were talking to an old man who said in his younger days, 50 years ago, there used to be 30,000 there. So thankfully, it's withering on the vine, as it were, but that superstition is still carried on. And they have sort of made a swimming pool where the waters from the well are collected, and sick pilgrims go there and bathe. You know, there's buses coming mm-hmm. day by day, apparently coaches, and they go there and they bathe in the water, and supposedly, it is said, in their own account, it is said there have been many cures, but of course it's all nonsense. And this is a money-making racket because of statues and amulets and all sorts sold. As all these places, of course, it's like Diana of the Ephesians, you know, Demetrius was making a nice packet out of it. In this case, the Church of Rome does. Yeah. Interestingly, in the Middle Ages, it was a nest of Jesuits.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the Protestant memorial in Chester, Martin's memorial in Chester, the Romanists managed to persuade a relative of the woman who paid for the memorial to be put up to have the name of a priest put on, a man called Pleasington, also alias Pleasington and Scarisbrick. He was a Jesuit, and he was executed for high treason in 1678, I think it was, or 1676, beatified by Pope Paul VI, as were all the so-called English martyrs, Roman Catholic English martyrs, who, by the way, they were all executed for high treason, not for what they believed, but for plotting to overthrow the state, and particularly the kingdom.
And bring it under the Pope's rule again.
Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And one of the two Jesuits that was involved in the gunpowder plot, he had been stationed there at Holywell. So it was a nest of vipers. Just across the estuary onto the Wirral, which is on the English side, there was a country house called Puddington Hall, where a Massey family lived, and Pleasington went across there and was hiding in a priest hole where Roman Catholics then came there to be ministered to. And later on, in the rebellion in Scotland, the Jacobite rebellion, as it's called, in 1746, he was involved in that and was put in prison, where he died shortly afterwards. So there's a long association with rebellion as well as the superstition surrounding Holywell. So that's one of the ones that's still going on, but not as strongly as it used to be, but with the blessing of Rome. They have the bishop of the diocese of the area there, as well as the priest. And we preach as they go past. They try and drown us out with a loudspeaker, and as they drone the rosary. But thankfully, it's just down to a couple of hundred. Now, the next one I want to speak about is called Edmund Arrowsmith. He was born in 1585. In 1605, he left England to study for the priesthood in the continent. Now, at that time, young Englishmen were forbidden to go as trained as priests on the continent because they were coming back, you see, sowing sedition and rebellion. And he joined the Jesuits in 1624, and he was arrested, charged with high treason, sentenced to death in 1628 by hanging, drawing, and quartering. Supposedly, devoted Roman Catholic cut off his arm and stole it away, and this is now preserved in a glass case, which is kept in a safe at a church near Manchester, a place called Ashton and Makerfield. And every afternoon, that black, wizened hand is taken out, and busloads of pilgrims go there. We've been there ourselves witnessing on one occasion. And the sick are taken there, and this wizened hand is placed on wherever the sickness is, or cloths are passed over it, you know, or rubbed on it. So there's this black, wizened hand of this man. It probably doesn't even belong to him, but they don't mind about that, is superstitiously venerated and supposedly has healing properties. They built a special church for it in the 1950s, and they have a feast day for him on August the 7th in the diocese. And he was beatified in by John Paul again in 1970.
Yeah.
Not John Paul, Paul the Sixth in 1970. So that, this is typical, of course, of Roman Catholicism. It's venerating bits of the dead or whole bodies of the dead or part of their clothing, like they venerate relics of the cross, supposedly, and crown of thorns and all this sort of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just rank, dark superstition.
And you know, as you pointed out, we're talking about, this is approved, promoted, encouraged by the Roman Catholic priesthood.
Well,
so this is not some breakaway sect calling themselves Roman Catholic. That's what we need to keep in mind here.
No, this is with the full authority and permission of the Church of Rome. We know this happens all over the world, but this is in supposedly enlightened England that this is happening.
Yeah. Now, does this sound like Christians? I mean, apart from everything else, and of course, you know, we could go right to the Mass and get started on that as far as, of course, this isn't a Christian religion. But this alone is superstition, it's witchcraft, it's sorcery, it's a cult, and that's exactly it to sum it up. This is not, just based on this alone, this is not a Christian religion, and yet new evangelicals are talking about Roman Catholics as Christian brethren all the time.
Well, of course, it just shows their ignorance of what Rome teaches, or alternatively, their ignorance of what the Bible teaches, or both.
A willing
Probably
ignorance.
Probably both in many instances.
In many instances, a willing ignorance. Look the other way. You
yeah.
Know?
One thing about relics, every Roman Catholic altar has to have at least two relics embedded in it.
Right.
So every Roman Catholic church throughout the world has relics in it.
Right. You remember up at La Crosse, you were here and we went
yes,
up there.
Yes, indeed.
And we went, that's quite a church, isn't it? That's a ornate church.
It's an exquisite building.
They spared no cost, and this is at the Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe, and they built it, of course, in the 80s, 90s, I think. But anyway, they have relics, bones from a Mohawk woman who became a nun. They have her bones in that church. And, of course, they also have, and you saw it with your own eyes, that one display where they have the sign of the turtle, because the turtle, the turtle was sacred to the Mohawk. So they incorporate that right in with all the other superstition.
Well, of course, it's just one form of paganism with another.
Right, exactly.
I mean, what has this got to do with biblical Christianity? And the answer is nothing at all.
Nothing.
It's to do with devilish superstition. And any person who's truly a Christian who cannot see that there's something radically wrong with them, as you say, willful ignorance in many instances. There's one final one I'd like to speak about. This is in Wales. It's to do with Mary, the veneration of Mary, called the Lady of the Taper, or of Cardigan. Cardigan is in the southwest of Wales. And the legend is that this statue was found by the river Theft, or something is pronounced, I can't quite pronounce it, in southwest Wales, with a burning taper in her hand. It was just found, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Another one of these that came out of the blue.
Yeah.
And so they set up a pilgrimage site in the area, and of course the superstitious went along there in their hundreds, if not thousands. When the Reformation came, in fact, before the Reformation, when Henry VIII had the monasteries investigated, that was one of the ones that was overthrown, and the statue was destroyed. However, in 1952, a new statue was cast, taken to the premier Roman Catholic Cathedral in London, Westminster Cathedral, in England indeed, and blessed. And of course, as you know, Roman Catholics, they bless all sorts of objects, as if you could somehow impart spiritual virtue into inanimate objects.
They bless cars, motorcycles, dogs, cats, people.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's no end to what they bless. Houses, this, that, and the other thing.
Well, then that was taken around the diocese, And a new church was built in 1966 to house this statue. And then in 1987, they had another statue made, cast in bronze. This was blessed in Cardiff Cathedral, which is in Wales. And a candle, she holds a candle in her hand, which is called the Lady of the Taper, of course. And this candle was blessed by John Paul II. Yeah. Again, it's with full papal knowledge, authority, and blessing. Mm-hmm. And that is a place of pilgrimage in southwest Wales. So again, we have all this superstition involving so-called martyrs, so-called of the Virgin Mary, of course. Many of them claim, of course, as you know, to have prayers answered.
Yeah.
When they pray to these people or have visions, and they're spoken to by the, you know, Mary or whoever it is, given directions what to do, all sorts of things. I mean, this is devilish, no matter what way you look at it.
It really is. If you go to these places, if you've ever been around any of them, you'll sometimes see these poor, deluded people on their knees in front of statues, and you know, even crawling around on their knees in front of statues, doing all sorts of things, trying to get miracles and blessings and so on and so forth.
Yeah, there's a famous tomb in London of one of the English kings called Edward the Confessor. They go there and pray. He was a Saxon king. They go there and pray, both Anglicans and Roman Catholics, at that statue. And, it's rubbed smooth, you know, like the Peter statue in Rome, supposedly. It's actually a statue of Zeus, apparently, is rubbed smooth where people rub their hands over it or even kiss it, you know.
Exactly.
So I've seen this in that pilgrimage program, you know, people there kneeling at this tomb. We have a tomb of St. Werburgh here in Chester. And when a so-called evangelical bishop celebrated the Anglo-Catholic Mass, on the program it was advertised in the afternoon, they were going to be praying at this tomb for revival in the parish.
Yeah.
And presumably this evangelical so-called bishop was involved.
Yeah. Well, you know, as we talk about the occult on that BBC program, you mentioned they are a cult because they pray to the dead. Necromancy. I mean, it's forbidden in the Bible, but when has that ever stopped the Roman Church from anything?
This is their stock and trade, you see. And this, you know, in medieval times, as I say, when there was no Bible allowed, you can understand how people, and of course they were totally uneducated for the most part, how people were taken in and deluded by it, and they were fleeced. You know, I mean, they had holy relics. There's a whole list of them given. The investigation of the monasteries in the time of Henry VIII. I mean, they had the afterbirth of Christ. They had the girdle Mary wore. They had even a feather from Agent Gabriel's wing.
Yeah. And they had
winking statues.
Apostles with many arms, legs, and heads.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, it's crazy. And one thing, I want to throw a few things out here. One thing about these shrines to their Virgin Mary, their goddess. She comes, of course, and she gives messages or has given messages in some places, they say still is, you know, it varies. But it's basically exalting herself all the time and pointing to herself all the time. And it's almost invariably about her, this goddess. And
well, if you ever see, you know, statues or iconography of Mary with the Lord, he's either a babe in her arms, or she's cradling him in her arms, having taken him down from the cross.
Yeah.
In other words, he's the helpless one, and she's the dominant figure.
Yeah.
He's the helpless babe or the dead person in her arms, having been on the cross. So this, of course, puts her in a very powerful position in the minds of Roman Catholics. And in fact, as you know, they teach that the Lord Jesus Christ is unwilling. He's a hard, harsh judge, unwilling to forgive the sinner. But if you go through Mary to him, you'll get your petition every time.
Oh, that's it. And that's her messages, too. I've read a number of her messages, and you've got to go through her, because otherwise he's not going to forgive anyone. He'd have nothing to do with anyone. The thing about these shrines, too, it's really about exalting, of course, this goddess. And you've probably had this experience, but our experience in witnessing the Catholics or going to Catholic events and witnessing is if you want to see them get really angry, and we've had some to the point of violence, really, wanting to do violence, it's their Virgin Mary, that if you in any way talk against what's taught about her, you can talk against the Pope, and they might, you know, they'll argue with you and debate and mock you, but when it comes to her, their goddess, you really stir up a hornet's nest.
No, you're touching a sore spot.
Absolutely.
Oh, very much so.
Now,
very much so.
Now, you have, you know, you've shared some of the, just you've scratched the surface, of course, on some of these pilgrimage sites. In America, we have some. Ours are not quite so dramatic in the United States of America. I think there's a reason for that. I think because of our, I mean, you had Romanism there before you had Protestantism.
Yes.
We didn't. We had Protestantism, and then the Romanism finally started coming in. So it's behind you somewhat. But we have, of course, the only Vatican-approved apparition site in America is here in Wisconsin at Green Bay. And it's not so dramatic other than, of course, there's all these healings, and there was a forest fire, and it burned all around the shrine, but it didn't touch it. But I mean, the goddess apparently appeared there, or supposedly, to Adele Bries, a Belgium immigrant, and, you know, a series of messages, and it's called Our Lady, or she's called Our Lady of Good Help. That's the apparition there. And, you know, she's responsible for healing, supposedly, but there's no bouncing heads or moving houses there. But we are getting more and more shrines around and apparition sites, and they will be approved. And it's a wink and a nod, and there's priests involved with all of them anyway. So it's just they haven't been officially approved by the Vatican. We've got another one in Wisconsin we've been to. It's very small, but a farm woman in the 1950s, supposedly Our Lady appeared to her and then, of course, gave her messages. And then she had the stigmata and all of that, the sign of the nails on her hands and the,
yes,
and the thorns on her head, supposedly. If you go down into South America, Mexico, and so on, then you're going to start getting more of these dramatic things, you know, starting, of course, with Juan Diego and Our Lady of Guadalupe appearing in the 16th century. That's a story I won't go into because I want to get to something else and get some comments from you. But there, Juan Diego, this peasant, had the goddess appear and give him some messages, and the bishop didn't believe it. So then the goddess had him go out in December when there's no roses blooming up to a hill, and there were roses, pick them, take them to the bishop to prove that, you know, she had really appeared. Juan Diego opened his tilma, the cloak he had, the flowers fell out, and there on the tilma was this imprint of the so-called Blessed Mother, the apparition. And so they supposedly have that in Mexico City, the original, and then they have replicas that they take around to abortion mills and other places here in America,
yeah,
because she's the protectress of the unborn, as well, yeah, as, by the way, the whole American continent has been entrusted to her by Pope John Paul, which we do not really appreciate that too much. Now, I want to jump right to this, though. If you can bear with me here, David, you'll have to listen,
yep,
to this. It's painful, and it'll take me a little while, but I know you know about the Day of the Dead.
Yes.
And maybe, well, I'll read, no, why don't you go ahead and tell a little bit about it, if you don't mind, about All Saints Day or the Day of the Dead, just briefly, and then I can read you something here that I think is, I think it's going to be a real eye-opener for the people here that are listening.
Well, first of all, before we actually get to that, you know, Halloween is also called All Hallows. And it's on that night that the souls are supposed to get out of purgatory.
Right.
So that's another heathen pagan superstition mixed in with a Romish superstition. Well, the Day of the Dead is when they go to this cemetery. I actually read an account about this. And they place flowers and candles on graves and so on. And all sorts of pageantry and what have you. But this report has said that actually a strange wind went howling through this village where he observed it. Because it's in more than one place, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
This is not As I understand it, this doesn't happen in just one location, but all over Latin America.
Right.
Especially Mexico, I understand.
Exactly, yep.
And so he said there was this strange, eerie wind, and to me that's satanic.
Yeah.
Went rushing through the village, you know, which is quite scary, really. But again, of course, it's like necromancy. It's consulting the dead, raising the dead even, supposedly. It's really occult.
Yeah, well, it's on actually November 2nd. And, you know, the Roman Catholic Church will call it All Souls Day, but they also now are just calling it the Day of the Dead as well. And what I had, and you were correct, Mexico is very big in Mexico. However, with this influx of illegal immigration or illegal immigrants from Mexico, and we're not against immigration, people should understand that, but, you know, there needs to be certain guidelines and there, people need to be in line to immigrate to the USA and do it the right way. And they need to be, of course, assimilated. And so you don't have floods of them, but we've got floods of them because of politicians who have pays them to have floods of them, and Roman Catholic priests, and right up to, of course, the Pope, who have encouraged this and even been involved in illegal activity and much political maneuvering and poured millions of dollars into keeping our borders open. Now, I won't go into that, but we've got it in especially the Southwest America now, Arizona and New Mexico and so forth. We have some as Day of the Dead. And then Mexico is very big and down through, you know, South America, Central America, and so forth. But here's what I want to do. We have been stressing that this superstition, this heathenism, this occultism, this is Roman Catholicism. And I want to read to you a statement put out by the Diocese of Orange County, California. Now, just stay with me and listen to this. Diocese of Orange celebrates All Souls Day in honor of the departed. Colorful banners, flowing flowers, and skeleton effigies are displayed at cemeteries. All right, that's the subtitle. Here it is. Orange County bishops and clergy will hold several outdoor masses celebrating All Souls Day, the ancient feast day honoring the dead, at Orange County's three major Catholic cemeteries. November 2nd, 2013, at 10 a.m., All Souls Day is a Roman Catholic holy day when one prays for the souls of the faithful departed still undergoing purification so as to achieve the holiness necessary to enter heaven, as the Catechism of the Catholic Church explains purgatory. This feast is an important tradition in Mexico and other parts of Latin America, where it is known as, and I'm not going to try to say the Spanish version here, but it says, or the Day of the Dead. So in other words, All Souls Day, the Day of the Dead, these are synonyms. The Diocesan Office of Hispanic Ministries will hold a special, well, there's the Spanish again, but it's Day of the Dead observance in Spanish, November 2nd, and it gives the date, same date, at Holy Sepulchre Cemetery in Orange. And that talks about Hispanic Christians from several parishes in the Diocese of Orange will gather at the Holy Sepulchre Cemetery for the annual outdoor mass to pay their respects and to celebrate the life of the loved ones who have departed. Here's a quote from a priest. This sacred tradition reminds us of our commitment to live holy lives and that our prayers can help in the purification of souls destined for heaven. Our annual celebration of All Souls Day highlights the rich culture and devotion of the people of our diocese. And that's a quote from a priest, Kevin Van, actually a bishop of Orange. Now, this is the part I want people to be sure and listen to. This is from the Roman Catholic Church. There are many customs and traditions that occur during All Souls Day, depending on the culture. An altar is often intricately built at the cemetery, offering food for deceased family members in the belief that the dead participate in the meal in spirit. The offerings are arranged with colorful banners and flowers, which serve as a living memorial of deceased loved ones. Candles, incense, mementos, photos, and other remembrances are used in the preparation of the altar, honoring the faithful departed. Day of the Dead is a tradition in Mexico and other Latin American countries. This observance dates back many hundreds of years and is associated with All Souls Day, so it's one and the same. Now, honoring departed family members. Now listen to this part. It is marked by festivities, including spectacular parades of skeletons and ghouls, Many families visit the graveyards of their loved ones and celebrate throughout the day with a picnic that's at the graveyard as they remember the deceased. One more paragraph or sentence or two here. Here's from this bishop again, Vaughn. The Day of the Dead is passionately observed by the Hispanic community in our diocese. It is an occasion for families to come together in prayer to celebrate a ritual that has profound spiritual and cultural importance. Well, David, did you hear this? I mean, this is All Souls Day / Day of the Dead, and they're promoting parades with skeletons and ghouls, and they're having an altar, a heathenish altar set up at the cemetery, putting food on it for the dead. I mean, don't tell me this is a Christian religion by any means.
Well, as I understand it, this Day of the Dead was something, of course, that was adapted from the native religions, Aztecs and so on, that preceded the Spaniards.
It's just incorporated into the Roman Church. They're expert at this.
Well, they've done that all over the world.
They have, and shamelessly, and it works. It works, whether in Haiti, where some of the Roman Catholic priests double at night as voodoo priests. I mean, it does work, doesn't it?
Well, it's from the same source anyway, because it is voodoo. And I mean, this offering of fruit to the dead, of course, is ancestor worship.
On an altar.
That's where that comes from.
It's unbelievable, but, just heard it. This was a statement issued by the Orange County Diocese. You heard the ministers, or the bishop, I should say, talking about this as part of All Souls Day.
Well, now isn't it time that those who call themselves evangelical woke up and stood up and were counted?
I would think
and
so.
And denounced this for what it is. Not the people, but the system.
Well, the first and great commandment, first and great, is that we're to love the Lord our God with all of our heart, mind, soul, and strength. The second is like unto it. We got to get the first one right first. And where's the love of the Lord Jesus Christ, for instance? Where's the love even of our neighbor with these poor Roman Catholic people when evangelicals are running around treating the Roman Catholic Church as if it's a Christian church and the Pope is a wonderful man?
Well, I mean, that says it all about how far evangelicalism has fallen from what it should be, how far it departed from the Bible. And of course, This is what happened with the early church, you see. Bit by bit, it brought in rituals and practices from heathenism. The Bible was ignored, like it is now by many evangelicals, and then the Bible was forbidden in the end.
Yeah.
And this is the same process happening all over again. That's how it goes. So evangelicals, you see, are not standing on the truth of what the Bible declares. They're not adhering to it. They're introducing innovations, and of course, when you start doing that, anything goes. And if it carries on, of course, it will go back to the pre-Reformation situation.
And as you look back over history, and we know that people in the world do have some understanding of Roman Catholic history. They know. They've heard about the Inquisition. They've heard about some of these things. And you look back, and if these people are Christians, which they are not, but if the world doesn't see a clear line of demarcation between us and them, then Christianity, true Christianity, is smeared with the dark and evil crimes of Romanism along with all of this superstition.
Well, of course, it's a common accusation of the Muslims that all Christians are, you know, crusaders.
Yeah.
Which, in fact, of course, simply isn't true, because at the same time as the crusaders were battling against the Muslims and massacring them in many instances, they were also launching crusades against the true Christians in the mountains and of southwest France and north Italy.
Absolutely,
for instance.
Absolutely, and popes were issuing bulls to urge them on in the murder, and the killing, in the
plunder.
When
when they went to Jerusalem and took Jerusalem, they put all the Muslims to the sword and they put all the Jews to the sword.
Yeah.
But, of course, on the way there, they sacked Byzantium as well, which was the Eastern Orthodox, now Constantinople or Istanbul. They sacked that as well.
Yeah.
And when Richard II, the so-called Lionheart, he captured Acre and Saladin, the Muslim general, if you like, pleaded like for clemency for the people, and Richard II said he'd show him what clemency was, and he put to the sword 80,000 men, women, and children.
Yeah, yeah. It's horrific.
You know, Well, you see, the Muslims say, well, they don't understand the difference between Romanism and true biblical Christianity. So we're all tarred with the same brush. Yeah. And I find in the open air, you see, time and again, amen, I have thrown in my face about the paedophile priests.
Yeah.
And so, well, I'm not Roman Catholic, of course, with an Irish accent, you see, that doesn't help. But we're all tarred with the same brush, you see.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we meet people who are very, very bitter, who are in the Roman Church and disenchanted with it, but yet they have this bitterness against all Christianity because of that church. I mean, you know, we're not going to get into Crusades because we don't have time to go there. We've talked about before, but I mean, people don't realize that there were Crusades, as you brought up, for instance, against the Waldenses, and it was just a combination of military forces and just a huge rabble loosed on those Christian brethren, and they were given the liberty to just own, possess, do what they want with the Waldenses, so long as they killed them in the end and take their property. It was rape, it was rapine, it was murder, it was torture, and the popes are the ones that said, do it.
Oh, yes. In fact, the Inquisition was instituted, I think, by, was it Innocent II or the Third? I'd have to look that up, but the Inquisition was instituted by the papacy. Yeah. And we need to emphasize that because Roman Catholic apologists try to say that, well, the Inquisition sort of was happened at a local level, that it happened without the authority of the church authorities, which is a total lie. Yeah. It was instituted by the papacy. It was supervised by the papacy. They charged the Dominicans, especially, with being inquisitors and sniffing out heretics and putting them to the stake. So it was the whole system was involved, headed up by the Pope. So this is a lie, of course, they try to excuse. And they try to minimize how many were actually killed. It runs into millions and millions.
And it's always, it was the civil authorities. Well, they were just the arm, the sword of, you know, the Pope had, of course, claimed the civil sword as well as the spiritual sword. And they were expected to do the killing.
But only were they expected, they were ordered to do so. And if they
didn't, they
themselves would have suffered the same fate.
Excommunicated, barred from heaven, and probably suffered the same fate. And, of course, there were plenty of priests with blood on their hands, too, that did their share of the torture and the killing.
Oh, absolutely.
The torture they always did, but the killing, too. And we have to wrap this up, but what have we gotten out of the papacy when it comes to the Inquisition? A few feeble remarks. To my knowledge, you may know more than I do on this, but a few feeble remarks about there were excesses or it was the times and et cetera. That's about it.
Yeah, it was sort of wasn't even half-hearted. It was 1% hearted.
Yeah.
They didn't own up to it at all, and they excesses. I mean, it was systematic.
Exactly.
It went on, in the case of the Waldenses, for 6 centuries. Unremitting cruelty. They waited. You know, the Bible described it, the whore drunk with the blood of the martyrs.
That's it right there.
They waded through the martyrs' blood.
Well, David, we have to wrap this up.
Yep.
I know that we have gotten into a subject where we could spend a lot more time together, but we have been very, very encouraged both by your stand, your consistent stand, by this update on your ministry. We know there are others, a remnant there that are standing as well, and you're working with some of them, of course, and leading them. Then there are other pockets, you might say, of faithfulness, and we're very, very encouraged, and we're reminded to pray for all of you. And thank you so much for everything you do. Pass that on to the others.
I certainly will.
God bless you.
God bless.